From the Moon Broadcast Center at KPCC, this is The Frame. I'm John Horn. On today's show, the casting of a lesbian actress as a lesbian Batwoman in a superhero story is raising a ruckus. We look into the controversy. And what's the best way to make a new story? From the mythology of Stephen King, the creators of Castle Rock share their starting point.
Who are the kinds of people that choose to stay? Who are the kinds of people that move to a place like Castle Rock after it's been terrorized by a rabid dog and a serial killer and the devil himself?
And in a new episode of Song Exploder, singer-songwriter Nico Case breaks down a tune from her new album. All that coming right up.
KPCC podcast supported by National Geographic's Genius Picasso, starring Antonio Banderas in the Emmy-nominated role as the 20th century's most influential painter. Nominated for 7 Emmys, including Outstanding Limited Series, natgeotv.com/FYC. And the HBO series Barry. NPR claims it's the best new comedy on television. For your Emmy consideration, nominated for 13 Emmys, including Outstanding Comedy Series.
Welcome to The Frame. I'm John Horn. Thanks for joining us. Ruby Rose has been tapped to play Kate Kane, also known as Batwoman, in the upcoming CW series Arrowverse. Ruby Rose fans were ecstatic, but the announcement also came with a backlash, some in the form of sheer homophobia. On social media, some people said it was wrong to cast a lesbian in the part, while others said that Rose wasn't gay enough. And her casting was also criticized because Batwoman is Jewish, while Rose is not. Batwoman was originally introduced by DC Comics as a love interest for Batman to dispel rumors that Batman was gay, but DC resurrected Batwoman in 2006 as a Jewish lesbian. To talk about the controversy, I called up Ramzi Fawaz. He teaches queer theory in American pop culture at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. When I spoke with Fawaz, we started with a bit of comic book history, specifically in the 1960s when comic book authors began creating characters who weren't the typical icons of white masculinity. Instead, they were outsiders, mutants like the X-Men, who spoke to marginalized groups, including the LGBTQ community and people with disabilities.
What you see with that shift in the 1960s and 70s is the making available of this mythic or iconic fantasy of superhuman power and ethical action in the name of the world and its safety and protection for a vast range of people. And it opened out the world of superhero comic books to a huge range of different kinds of superhumans, like mutants and freaks and monsters. And that was monumental.
The first appearances of Batwoman go back to 1956, and her presence is really kind of interesting. She was supposed to be this antidote to some people thinking that Batman was gay, and gay characters were barred by the Comics Code Authority.
Yeah.
Can you tell us a little bit about what the rules were back then and what could and could not be done in comic books?
So the Comics Code Authority emerges in the mid-50s as a response to this huge conservative backlash against comics. And so the Comics Code Authority was a self-censorship project among comic book creators to show the public, look, we hear you. We're going to tamp down on this kind of storytelling. But ironically, when comic book creators turned the superhero into an outcast, a genetic and species outcast and a rebel, they actually managed to reinvent that genre, the superhero, into a rebellious act.
And the fact that the Comics Code Authority was worried about how stories would impact young readers is telling, because that means that when there's a shift and comics start representing the world the way that it really is, it does have the ability to change the way that people see themselves in relationship to others.
100%, because comics are fantasies. They allow us to project a variety of either idealized or utopian promises about what we want the world to be or how we imagine it could be. Anything that can be drawn can be believed. We will buy into it. Superhero comics are a particularly powerful fantasy genre because they allow us to imagine what it would be like to inhabit the body differently, to be a different body or to have a body that extends into the world in new and unpredictable ways. Because of that, comics were particularly dangerous and remain very potent.
One of the things that, to me, is the most interesting about the Ruby Rose story in relation to Batwoman is that she's either too gay or not gay enough. And there appears to be a lot of kind of polarized resistance. There is this streak of anti-feminist sentiment, something that we've seen in video gaming. And then there's this backlash from queer feminists. How do these superhero stories tend to divide people and sometimes bring them together over such an easy issue as casting Ruby Rose?
The superhero is an extremely powerful fantasy of agency and power. And think about it, we're living in a political moment where so many of us feel politically impotent. We feel that we cannot change the course of where our government is going. And this is true across the political spectrum, right? So imagine superheroes are incredibly powerful because they are a fantasy of being able to extend out of your body powers that allow you to have an influence on the world. And moreover, they're also a fantasy about how you can use those powers for ethical good. So because of that, it makes sense that the superhero polarizes people because it's a fantasy that allows people across the political spectrum to imagine what it would be like to affect change in a very material, physical way on the world.
Let me ask you this last question. There are the kind of coded ways that, say, LGBTQ characters can be depicted. It's very easy to look at the X-Men comics and movies. And then there's characters who are outwardly LGBTQ. And then there's this new area that I think we haven't gotten to where characters are LGBTQ, but that isn't the main focus of the narrative. So what happens next? Where are we headed in your mind?
I think the problem we're facing now is that mass media underrepresents minority subjects so badly that right now we're just obsessed with having a base level of diversity. We get Ruby Rose, but Ruby Rose just isn't adequate enough to the task of showing a vast range of lesbian subjects. So what I think needs to happen, and is already happening, is that a lot of different minority demographics and groups need to start taking control of American media and start telling the stories that they want to see and start proliferating all of these new kinds of characters. And I think it is happening. But I don't think demanding that any one actor or any one character fulfill all of our fantasies is going to work.
Ramsey Fawaz teaches queer theory and American pop culture at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. He's the author of the book, The New Mutants, Superheroes, and the Radical Imagination of American Comics. Ramsey, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thank you.
Audiences will get to see the first appearance of Ruby Rose as Batwoman in the Arrow crossover event scheduled for December. Coming up, the creators of Castle Rock talk about how they kept Stephen King mega fans and neophytes in mind when creating their Hulu series.
KPCC podcasts are supported by National Geographic's Jane, a film by Brett Morgan and the most Emmy-nominated documentary of the year, called one of the best documentaries of all time by Vogue. The film profiles legendary conservationist Jane Goodall and was created from over 100 hours of never-before-seen silent archival footage. Nominated for 7 Emmys, including exceptional merit in documentary filmmaking. Visit natgotv.com/FYC for more information.
And the HBO drama Game of Thrones. Time calls it the biggest and most popular show in the world. In the epic season 7 of this colossal hit, the people of Westeros fight for their seat on the Iron Throne. Winter is here, and beyond the Great Wall that protects them, a forgotten evil has returned. The most Emmy-nominated program this year is nominated for 22 Emmys, including Outstanding Drama Series.
Welcome back to The Frame. I'm John Horn. There have been countless adaptations of Stephen King's books and stories over the years, but the new Hulu series Castle Rock is something different. The series uses familiar King characters, locations, and themes, but it is not based on a King book or story. Instead, it's an original and terrifying tale about a haunted prison, a mysterious stranger, and all sorts of death and decapitation.
Technically, we don't have to disclose, since nobody died on the property. I mean, a serial strangler died in my house, and I sleep like a baby. Look, there is a lot of history in this town. not all of it good.
That is an understatement. Show creators Sam Shaw and Dustin Thomason wrote the series in a way that King neophytes could understand, but also included scores of Easter eggs for King's most obsessive fans. When I spoke with Shaw and Thomason, I wanted to know about the first time that they read a Stephen King story. The first voice you hear is Sam Shaw.
I spent 7 summers as a kid at a sleepaway camp in Maine.
Like it's its own horror story right there.
There were a lot of tears and a lot of homesickness. But at some point, somebody passed me a dog-eared, broken-spined paperback copy of Pet Sematary. So my sort of like formative experience of Stephen King is the memory of reading those books by flashlight in a tent with an extremely full bladder, much too terrified to unzip and leave. So there's a sort of like Pavlovian sense of discomfort that is connected with Stephen King for me.
Dusty, what about you?
For me, it was It was really the first defining Stephen King experience. And I think part of it is, as we all know, Stephen King writes these incredible stories that some of which are 1,000 pages long. And I think for a kid growing up in Northern Virginia, obsessed with sports and running around the neighborhood, picking up this 1,000-page tome about a killer clown and the children that he terrifies in a town that sort of felt not so dissimilar to the one I grew up in, and actually making it through the first 1,000-page book that I had ever read, I think really transformed my experience of reading, to be honest. It was sort of a moment where I realized that books was something that I could get lost in and that it was really going to be an important part of my adult life.
There is so much Stephen King out there, and you are approaching his storytelling from a different perspective, which is to make kind of a composite, indirect adaptation of his world. So at what point did you decide that you were going to do something that was as much an aggregation of his ideas as it was a direct adaptation of a specific story or book?
The sort of first step for us was to revisit as many of those formative, iconic books and adaptations as we could, and try to kind of reverse engineer a sense of what are the story structures, what are the tropes, what are the ideas, what are the themes that are uniquely Kingian that sort of make a Stephen King story a Stephen King story.
Yeah, and I think that we were really interested in the idea that all of these stories have taken place in this town and that Stephen has returned to them again and again, and to the people who live in this very small town in southern Maine. And the idea that after all of these terrible things have happened, these people have actually stayed in this town. And I think part of the kernel of the idea was sort of to look at who are the kinds of people that choose to stay, who are the kinds of people that move to a place like Castle Rock after it's been terrorized by a rabid dog and a serial killer and the devil himself. And I think it was from that place that we started to think, well, if there was a story where you could really embrace the idea of bringing Castle Rock into 2018 and looking at those people in America now and thinking about how they ended up there, how they ended up staying there, that would be something really interesting as a kind of new chapter in the Stephen King library.
We're talking with Sam Shaw and Dusty Thomason. They are the creators and showrunners of the Hulu series Castle Rock. The story really centers on Henry Deaver, who's played by Andre Holland. A lot of people probably know him from Moonlight, the Oscar-winning movie. He's a Texas death row attorney and a Castle Rock native who's been away for a very long time. At what point did you say this is going to be one of the centers of our story? Because there's multiple storylines, but a lot of it would be seen through Henry's eyes.
That was really one of the first creative choices that we made. It's a story of a sort of native son who's left, who returns and is able to provide a kind of outsider's view of a place with which he has an intimate history. In this case, it was particularly interesting because, you know, Maine is the whitest state in America. Castle Rock is a pretty lily-white town in a lily-white state. And, among the different sorts of contemporary questions that we wanted to raise and explore over the course of the season is this sort of question of what it would be to look at this town as somebody who has been treated as an other and who has in some ways gotten a short end of a stick
I'm going to play a scene from episode 2 where Henry is talking to a character named Jackie at a bar, and she fills him in on what's been said about him since he left town.
Kids used to dress up like you for Halloween, but then somebody Instagrammed a photo and it became a whole thing. The blackface.
Okay, let's hear it. What's the story?
Beloved local preacher opens his home and his heart to poor screw-up orphan. Weirdo kid. Gets weirder. You lure him out to Castle Lake. Push him off the rocks. Bye-bye, bastard deaver. Wander out of the woods 11 days later and pretend you can't remember what happened.
This is a big idea in the series, like what people have done, what they're suspected of doing, what's hidden in their past. Did you find yourself coming back to that idea repeatedly through pretty much every episode?
Yeah, we did. I mean, one of the sort of tropes that Stephen King is obsessed with is this idea that the traumas of childhood define the arc of adulthood. So many of the great kind of iconic King stories are about the event that has cast the shadow over adult life. And often what that involves is an element of storytelling and myth-making, that which is remembered, exaggerated, forgotten. This is a thing that we were really interested in when we were exploring the kind of anthropology of a town like Castle Rock that has been on the wrong end of this sort of biblical onslaught of nightmares and disasters for decades and decades and centuries, is how have they tried to make sense out of everything that they've been subjected to? What are the stories and the myths that have emerged? Has it drawn them together as a community? Has it sort of atomized them and split them apart? So it was something that we talked about a lot in the writer's room.
Castle Rock is obviously a big character in the story, and in the show it's referenced by one character as Fallujah. So when you're searching for the right city that's going to play Castle Rock, A, how do you find it? And B, how do you tell people, just so you know, your city is going to be this den of horrors?
Gently. I think we found an amazing town in Massachusetts, about an hour outside of Boston, that is called Orange, Massachusetts. And it's a really interesting town because there's a ton of kind of bucolic beauty and sort of the lovely feel of a small town that still exists and that sort of once thrived more. And the people were incredibly welcoming. They, some of the storefronts even, I think, still say like Castle Rock Pizza in Orange, Massachusetts. And honestly, it was amazing because we were able to basically control the entire town when it came to shutting down streets, and they were really supportive, which was great. And one funny thing was that we, when we scouted it, it was actually sort of the dead of winter, and it looked incredibly desolate in a way that made it almost perfect for Castle Rock. And then we started filming and headed towards our sort of July start date. We realized that as the trees came out, it turned into kind of a really lovely place that one might actually like to live. And so it was a funny transition, but they were really wonderful to us throughout the production.
Something we knew right out of the gates was that this was a show that we'd have to shoot practically. We had sound stages, we had beautiful sets, but there's a sort of texture to natural light and, you know, wind blowing through leaves and dust in the air that you can't approximate. And, you know, in a show that is titled Castle Rock, that is fundamentally kind of an exploration of this town, we knew that finding the right place would be, in a way, our kind of crucial piece of casting for the season.
When you are putting together your writer's room, at what point is some or a lot of knowledge of Stephen King necessary? Is there some sort of quiz where you go, okay, Stephen King's job before he was a writer, was it chemist, journalist, teacher, mechanic? Which one?
No, there was no litmus test. It's a little like the Supreme Court. No, but we tried to cast a pretty wide net. We have a pond stocked with the best, smartest writers we know, and also different levels of familiarity with Stephen King and the Stephen King library. So we had, you know, Stephen King black belts and plenty of Stephen King virgins as well. And it was really important to us to construct a story that, you know, we hope will be exciting and welcoming to a viewer who may not identify as a fan of Stephen King, and also to sort of include enough nods and winks and Easter eggs and cross-references to sort of satiate PhD-level Stephen King completist.
Sam Shaw and Dusty Thomason are the creators and showrunners of Castle Rock. You could find it on Hulu. Sam and Dusty, thanks so much for coming on the show.
Hey, thank you for having us.
Thank you.
Episode 6 of Castle Rock is out today on Hulu. The series has just been renewed for a second season. And now it's time for another installment of Song Exploder. That's the great podcast from our friend Hrishikesh Hirway, in which he gets musicians to break down a particular song. Today it's singer and songwriter Nico Case. She's been nominated for multiple Grammys. And in addition to making her own music, she's also a member of the band, The New Pornographers. Earlier this summer, she released her 7th album. It's called Hell On, which she also co-produced. In this episode, Nico breaks down the song Last Lion of Albion. Albion is one of the oldest names for the island of Great Britain, and it was while Nico was in England that this song first took shape.
My name is Nico Case. I remember being in England on tour and, you know, I'm always looking for history everywhere I am. And I, you know, there's lions on everything in England and it's a pretty popular crest. And I just remember thinking how sad it was that all the lions of England were extinct. I was sitting in a coffee shop in Shoreditch, super jet lagged. And I think I was just thinking like, oh, what would it feel like to be the last lion of Albion? And then I just started writing little pieces down and then I would leave it and then come back to it. At the same time, my boyfriend, Jeff, was working on just recording little things because he likes to record things. So he just had this really cruddy nylon string guitar and he was just making these really excellent sounds because you can really bend the strings on those things. And I said, can I steal that riff right there? I'm like, are you using that? He's like, no, I don't have any plans for it. So that was the key element. Like, that was definitely the heartbeat of the song. It takes it out of the Western scale just slightly, and it fluctuates in and out of tune so frequently and in such an awesome way. Then I just started singing the lines that I had written down.
Last line of Albion, they'll use you for centuries to come. They'll steal your patents for the sun, and you'll feel extinction when you see your face on their money.
I thought about all of the ways in which rich groups of people or colonialists immortalized themselves, like with coins and statuary and buildings. And, you know, I just thought, what would be a good spell? What would be a way to, like, send some sort of message to some ancient gods that would bring this lion, this creature back for revenge? And I just thought of the coin, like the way you'll trace a coin with your thumb or your finger over and over again.
I wish I could trace the frowning compass of your mouth. Drop a mercury dime down a Roman drain and summon Mars.
The real big fantasy is that, you know, all those businessmen like Elon Musk and Donald Trump who have bought everything already, like, I'm sure there are people that have, like, deeds to Mars and, you know, they're thinking about trashing this planet and they're going to go to this other planet where the poor people aren't or something. I just hope all the lions are just waiting there. And when they go down the stairs in their space machines, the lions just devour them.
Late in the heavens that are already bored, sleeps a red planet in the galaxy of lion's thoughts.
The Farfisa is Björn Yttling from Peter, Bjorn, and John. And that sound is one of the reasons I really wanted to co-produce with him on half the record. It really helped with the grindy desperation.
Last line of Albion, they'll use you for centuries to come.
That was Katie Lang, and I'm so glad that she did the backup singing on it, because sometimes you can harmonize with your own voice and it works, and sometimes it vibrates too badly in a way that isn't good. Like, I have a really nasal voice, so I don't blend really well with people, and sometimes not with myself either. So luckily, she swooped in and saved the day.
Last line of Albion, they'll use you for centuries to come. They'll steal your patents for the sun, and you'll feel extinction when you see your face on their money.
I'm there for every single second of the making of the record. I think I'm just a control freak, and that's like a very good trait to have if you're gonna be a producer, maybe. It's not lovely, but I don't think I've ever really done it any other way. Like, even, you know, on my first record, when I wasn't quote unquote producing it, I still had a lot of opinions and wanted things turned up or down. I just was so ravenous to make something, the roles and the thoughts didn't occur to me. It's listening, having an opinion, chasing a sound, being curious about a sound. So I can go, yeah, I'm a producer, or I'm a songwriter, or I'm a performer. I can definitely say those things, but it took a long time. I don't know if that's a thing for women or if that's a thing for people who don't feel like they own themselves in a way. I'm not really sure. I definitely think it took a lot longer than it should have. But I feel like I know who I am, and I'm okay with that.
And that'll do it for today. But one more thing, if you're a social media hound, make sure you follow us on Twitter and Facebook. You'll find us at The Frame. I'm John Horn. We'll see you back here tomorrow. Hey,